We've got it all for you tonight on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to be talking about the Druid Code, about the occult, and also puzzling people, about psychopaths, all kinds of things for you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM as we go live to Europe with Thomas Sheridan on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to talk with Thomas Sheridan about several things. One of his first books was Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath. And another one is a new one, The Druid Code, Magic, Megaliths, and Mythology. Thomas is an internationally renowned author, musician, public speaker, researcher, best known for this book, Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath. He has continued his own creative exploration, trying to find out what the heck is going on this planet. And here he is live from Ireland on Coast to Coast. Thomas, hello there. I guess I should say good morning, huh?
Indeed, George, it's 8 a.m., but I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for that very nice intro.
Well, I'm looking forward to this, and I'm looking forward to having you on regularly, Thomas, because your work is fantastic.
Oh, thank you very much, George. That means a lot. I've been a massive fan of the show. Like, when I was back working on Wall Street, I used to work late at night, I would listen to Coast, and it was a beacon of sanity. It was a beacon of sanity. No matter what the topic was, it was more normal and more adjusted than what I was dealing with in my job.
What got you back to Ireland?
Basically, well, we can talk about it. It was kind of a strange experience. I was working for a Wall Street investment bank. Now, I was a communications consultant and a graphic designer. My job was to take complex ideas and put them into very sellable, regular language, which has actually helped me in my own work, writing books and so on. But what really happened was, and this is a true story, I was one day sitting at a meeting, and we were going through this. It was a proposal to privatize a public utility. I think it was in here, Honduras and El Salvador. I think it was a power station. And I would sit there with these big top guys from Wall Street, and I'd go through the list, and I'd say, we need X amount of money for this, for upgrading the transmission system, X amount of money for this, that, and the other. And I'm going down the list, and I see this thing called ancillary war chest. And I say, what's this, guys? And they all burst out laughing and looking at each other, and they say, oh, that's the money we put aside to pay off union leaders, assassinate them, and pay off politicians, whatever we have to do to get this done.
Wow.
And that was the end for me. Now, it wasn't because it was just business or anything. It was just I didn't want to be part of it. I wanted to go back to doing the good things in life, having fun and you know, creating. I didn't want to be part of that anymore.
Were they serious, or were they pulling your leg?
They were serious.
They were.
Welcome to big business. Yeah, it's just business. Don't get upset about it. They have to do what they have to do. Now, they joked about it, but they laughed about it. But the look on their faces was like, next question, Thomas.
Yeah, right. Let's skim over this one, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I want to talk with you for some time here, Thomas. You're with us for 2 hours, so we got a lot of time here. Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath. Tell me about that, and what got you to write it? Was it because of your Wall Street experience?
Yeah, definitely. I have to say it was. Now, I've done a lot of jobs since I've left school. I've played in a rock band. I've done all kinds of things. I worked on construction sites. I worked as dishwashers, and I kind of worked myself up. I put myself through college.
Good for you.
I paid out of my own pocket. So I've seen a very broad spectrum of life. And what I've noticed is, no matter what the industry was, whether it was the hospitality industry, the music industry, the financial industry, as you move towards the top, a kind of an emerging curve of pathology starts to appear. It's almost like you're scaling up a mountain, and you would start and you'd hit the tree line, and then the tree line would end, and then you might see mountain goats. When you get to a certain point in every profession, there was a certain point where a particular type of individual would arrive on the scene. Very different than the ones you had met on the way up. You may have met creeps and jerks, annoying people, people who drove you crazy, people who were, you know, made your job difficult, even basic sort of workplace bullies.
Yeah.
You'd meet this kind of soulless, is the only way I could describe it, individual. They were almost like, it doesn't matter if they were male, female, whatever background they were from, nationality, it did not matter. It was like they had come through a mold. Preformed, and somehow they arrived at these positions. I don't know how. Lots of them didn't seem to have been fully qualified. They seemed to have got there by connections, you know, sycophancy, these kinds of things. And when you would hit them, there was a dark. Now, first of all, when you encountered them, there was an incredible superficiality about them. want to be your best buddy, this, that, and the other, you know, this kind of thing, this whole kind of like, you know, I'm on your side, guy, blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff, right? And then that would be great, but you'd also be kind of like, it's not real at the same time, too. Suddenly, if something went suddenly wrong, I mean, a little thing, like you drop something that you're going to hand them to you, you would see almost like this predatory being emerge from behind them and would appear in their eyeballs. It was almost like the real operating software below was suddenly switched on, and the antivirus software that they function with, that allows them to deal with everyday life, went off, and suddenly you were exposed to something. And what you saw in those eyes, what you looked at in those eyes, wasn't a human being staring back at you. There was a definite lack, and that was a huge, big trait for me, because then I began studying. I was always interested in serial killers. I'm a huge fan of the British writer Colin Wilson. He's like me, and he was like me, interested in loads of things. But he wrote some very good books on serial killers, and he kept talking about, in criminal profiles and also in books written by criminal psychologists, there's nothing behind them. You suddenly you're encountered by a flashpoint during a police interrogation, whatever, the ones who are criminally minded, and there's a point where you look in the eyes and there's a deadness there. There's a coldness. And I started to see this at the top echelons of whatever industry I was in. Not a lot, enough to notice there was something weird going on. You would stare at them, they stare back at you, and then I started to put two and two together. I said, oh my God, what I'm dealing with in my job is exactly what's being profiled as this serial killer, whatever his name is, anywhere in the world. And I started putting two and two together and started to realize that the best way to get ahead in big business, entertainment, finance, to get to the very, very top, is to not to be a great, not to study theology, I'm talking about religion as well, not to study theology, you know, finance, none of those things. The best thing to do would be study a serial killer, because that's exactly what gets to the top. And that's what began the journey of writing Puzzling People.
And there are lots of them out there that act this way, aren't there?
According to official numbers, there's 1% across society, and I think that's correct. If you go across all society, from rural to urban to middle class, suburban, all the way up to the top, that number sounds about right. But when you get into the professional world, there's two dynamics take place. Firstly, as I said, you meet the real ones, the real cold reptilian entities that have this hyperactive reptilian complex at the very top. At the same time, too, you meet people who I call proto-psychopaths, who may be okay, but they've almost like been damaged, and they think the only way they can get ahead is by emulating this kind of pathology. Oh, you know, get him before he gets us. Cut his throat before he cuts mine. You know, if you don't do it now, if you don't, look after number one. And these are sometimes quite often normal people. You have a situation where the pathology of the actual environment becomes psychopathic. You see that in politics a lot. The environment of the actual environment itself becomes pathological. And for anyone to survive, it's almost like they're reduced to a kind of a consciousness cannibal or a consciousness parasite, where they have to actually feed or live off this kind of thing. And they're often transformed. And this is the great danger, and this is what really brought me out doing this work, is because society is slowly being dragged into what I call the psychopathic control grid, because this is what's rising to the top everywhere. And we're being sucked into this world, all of us, even on smaller levels, even like things like neglecting our communities, neglecting our families, neglecting ourselves, and to become like this beast at the top. And this is the problem. And yes, there are a lot of them in the top professions, but definitely, and especially in urban areas, I've noticed.
Is this a trait, Thomas? A successful trait? You have to be a psychopath in order to be successful?
No, I don't agree with that. I think there's lots of great, talented people who definitely got to the top through talent, personality, and hard work. I know many people in all kinds of professions who got to near the top or very top through hard work. They really did. They you know, and their talent. But a quick way, or should we say a cheat, you know, like you have in video games, you have cheats. Well, a cheat sheet for them is the psychopath who get in there to play mind games with people in the office, to destroy people behind their backs, win the confidence of someone, and then tear them apart. Now, where you get a lot of them is in things like bureaucracy, in governments. Because in a, let's look at a government job. It's basically most government jobs in the West, it's almost impossible to get fired. So therefore, that's a perfect environment. I'm not saying government employees or public servants are all psychopaths. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that's an ideal position for one of them to get into. All they have to do is play the game, and they'll be moved from department to department if they get things wrong. But if they spend their time and they have enough, you know, perdition, and they're pernicious enough, they will get to the top of these bureaucracies. And this is where this attitude of you can't fight City Hall comes from. The top, often the most dangerous people in a government are not the elected politicians, but the high-ranking public servants who've been put into positions that give them extreme power, and they've never stood for a single election in their lives. And they are the ones that really frighten me, because that's becoming a bigger thing more and more. It's this kind of oligarchy takes over politics, these what they call this czar and that czar, or so on.
So what are they saying about our presidential election out that way, Thomas?
Well, look, I've known the United States inside out. It's like my second home. It's like the country I love dearly. And so I understand America, but a lot of people over here have a cartoon version of America, which is not surprising, because you get that. I'm sure you have a cartoon version of Ireland. That's normal. But there's this kind of thing, like there's this developing dynamic, which is quite frightening, where Donald Trump is somehow a monster and Hillary Clinton is somehow a saint. And if someone like me turns around and says, I'm afraid you might be getting that in reverse, or not that quite black and white, they go crazy. They have this thing like, they still have this thing like, the Democrats wonderful, Republicans evil, and big business, you know. And I'm saying, look, it's not that black and white. And it's, you know, this woman, Hillary Clinton, has quite a scary record when you look at it, you know, in terms of her own foreign policy thing. And she's never held an elected position in her life. Her behavior when Gaddafi was murdered is one of the strangest things I've ever seen in my life. And so you say this to them. So they have a very black and white thing. Quite a lot of people here are actually terrified of Trump, to be honest with you. It's the great unknown thing. It's the great unknown. But I saw that in the past with Ronald Reagan and other people. They don't know yet. Also, the media here is the media in Ireland is just, you think the media is like biased in the US. The media in Europe, Britain and Ireland is terribly, extremely culturally Marxist and left wing. So they will whip anyone who's not like, a micrometer,
yeah,
you know, left of center will be vilified.
Now, these psychopaths that are out there, are they born this way? Or are they created because of environment and things like that?
Well, this was a big thing for me. It was so big for me looking into this stuff that I actually decided I'm not even going to spend too much time on it, because it's much more important that people know the dangers to avoid them rather than be worried about their origin story, because the simple reason is there's tremendously conflicting information out there regarding this. I will tell you one thing, and I can state this categorically. They're absolutely born that way. Absolutely, they're born that way. It's not brain damage. It's not environment. I'll tell you some stories. I've known women who are maternity nurses, and they would say every so often, especially in a small town where they know the women giving birth and they know the children are being born, they would say every so often a mother will give birth to a baby. That's like, there's something not right when you hold it. There's something energetically wrong about it. And when it comes to things like breastfeeding time, there's not a mother and child bonding. It grabs, it's almost like an attack, like a savagery towards the mother when it wants to get fed. And then often they'll tell you that when these ones grew up, by the time they were 15, 14, 12, 13, they were sexually promiscuous criminals. They were hanging out with kids much older than them. They were involved in, and many of them, and they all turned out to be classic psychopaths. Huh. Now, there was a very good survey in 2010, I believe it was, 2008, that was in Florida, where they isolated some children, young children that had psychopathic traits, and they put them in a group with other children, and immediately they saw that they were very different. They would immediately began to create, with the children who did not show psychopathic traits, they would do things like they would move little groups of them off and then band them together to say attack another child in another functional child in a group, almost like a little mini cult leader developing his or her little cult to attack others, and then use these little other kids around them who are normal as almost like their attack dogs. And this was being shown up in kids as young as 4, 5, and 6. So they're definitely born that way. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
Are they intelligent?
They're devious. Now, devious
and intelligent big
are
difference.
Different things. Yep. Big difference thing. They have a predatory awareness. That's not the same thing. They have absolutely no creativity. They're terrible at creativity. You will never, if you ever see them try to write poetry, it's ridiculous. If you ever see them try to like do any kind of artistic, it's always a scam. They'll throw a bit of paint on a canvas and talk about some nonsense about being this, that, and the other. And there's a lot of that kind of thing goes on. But they're devious. They are ardent students of human behavior like you would not believe. They could walk into an office, a factory, a farm, anything, a fast food restaurant, as an employee, or even as a customer, as a casual observer, and within probably a couple of hours, they would know that what her problem is, well, her and her husband are getting divorced. I can actually use that against her. Him, what's his story? Oh, he's secretly gay, but he never told anybody. Good, I have something to blackmail him with. That kid over
Jeez.
There, what's wrong with him? He's insecure. Maybe I can use him.
How do they pick up on that so quickly, Thomas?
They're not human. I mean, that's if someone asked me the final judgment on psychopaths, I would say you're not dealing with a human being. You're dealing with some kind of predator in a skin job, in a skin suit. It's like a robot, and it because it has nothing else inside itself, it devotes all its time to, you know, predatory awareness and behaviors.
Does it feed on the misfortunes of others?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, sure, they'll capitalize it. It's the ultimate parasite. Like, you have, like, a situation, say you had an environmental disaster, a flood or something like that. Well, they would be not the ones going out looting. They would be the ones sending kids out to get looting. So if there's any danger, the kids get into danger, and then they would steal the stuff. They would be very, you know, they don't like to get their hands dirty. Oh, they would love anything like that. When, you know, during World War II, in my second book, Defeat the Demons, I speak about this French doctor. He was a GP, and what he was doing was most of his clients were Jewish, and when they had the invasion, when the Third Reich took over Paris, he started telling all his Jewish clients that he could arrange to get them on, you know, fruit boats to South America to smuggle them out of their country. And he told them, write letters to your family saying you're going to Argentina. Tell nobody you did it. Tell nobody anywhere anything about this, and I will set everything up for you. And then he would gas them and kill them, chop them up and bury them in his backyard, and then go to their house and take all their antiques. And when the war was over, the French police found that he had the biggest art and antiques collection in Paris, in his house. And his backyard was full of something like 40 or 50 bodies.
Jeez.
Yep.
Frightening.
Just business.
And they walk among us.
If you know 100 people, you know at least one. If you're in big business at the top of entertainment or anything, you'll know.
Do you generally like them or not?
Do I generally like them?
People in general. Do you generally like the psychopath? You obviously, you don't know it when you meet them, but so do you like them initially?
It depends on your personality type. If you're a decent, good-meaning person, you'll be easily trapped by them. It's the same kind of dynamic that works with cults. They'll find that something that's wrong with you. Like, you're lonely, you're sad, you're insecure, you don't feel good about things you do, and they will build you up and make you feel wonderful. So, they'll do that. They'll play on your mind, and then they will take that away, or they will begin this thing called gaslighting. Now, gaslighting is a very fascinating phenomenon, and it's changing your sense of reality. So basically, they could take a person who has low insecurity, build them up, and then learn by taking it away, like, say, they're praising them constantly, and then removing the praise.
Crushing them.
Then they can modify their behavior to the point where the person doesn't even know if they're coming or going or who they even
are. Wow, and they enjoy that. Thomas, when we come back, let's talk about your latest work, The Druid Code, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Up next, we're going to talk about the Druid Code, magic, megaliths, and mythology with Thomas Sheridan. Okay, we're back with Thomas Sheridan, his work, The Druid Code. Tell us a little bit about this book, Thomas, the title, The Druid Code.
Well, while I'm, you know, looking out for psychopaths and pointing them out to people trying to help people, or chasing serial killers through the, possible serial killers through the streets of, like, the canal system of Manchester, I need to relax now and again. And apart from rock and roll and comedy, the two things in my life that have always meant so much to me is megaliths, sacred sites, and I'm very fortunate to live in a part of the world where there's an abundance of them, and mythology. And I came to the conclusion more and more, just 25 years I've been going to these places, that they were calling me. There was an actual voice or something in these sites. There was something in there that was calling me. I would walk for miles in the middle of the remote mountains where I live, and here in the west, northwest coast of Ireland, suddenly find a ring of trees and sit in it, and then look on an old ancient map and discover that it used to be what they call a fairy fort. And so there was an energy in these places that I could never quite put my finger on. At the same time, too, a few years ago, I went to an event in England, and they had these guys dressed up as druids, and they weren't druids. They were just like, I don't know what they were. It was like a pageant or a party. So I wanted to find out the real thing. Now, what I found was there was two aspects to the druids. There was one, the Roman aspect, which is pure propaganda. They tell them that all they did was commit human sacrifice, that they were brutal, that they burned people alive in wicker men and all this kind of thing. But that's very much an imperialistic view of an enemy race, because the Druids gave the Romans a horrific time in Britain, and they almost defeated them with the Iceni Revolt in AD 60. And then they decided to wipe the Druids out and then wipe their reputation out through propaganda. But what happened was the Druids remained in Ireland, very, very powerful. And not only did they remain into the Christian era, but they remained as a group called the Philid. They were everything the Druids were, except they didn't preach religion, but they had all the other aspects. And suddenly there was I wanted to know, why did Druids exist? Why they lasted so long in Ireland? Why they were so powerful? And what their legacy was. And I began this investigation starting about 5 years ago, very seriously. After puzzling people came out, I decided to look at this thing for a future project. And what I discovered was that they left an enormous legacy in Western esoteric tradition, everything from magic, and that's to Freemasonry, to the occult, all of it. Even aspects of Christianity in Europe, they played a huge part in formulating it. And it is, I think it's the greatest untold story ever. And I wanted to put this together in relation to the mythology, which proves what they were on about. Now, the fundamental thing is that they knew something happened to the human race in the past that caused something to happen to human consciousness, and it changed it. And Druids became almost like the stewards of human consciousness in Western Europe. Same way the Brahmins did in the Vedic world. And they brought our consciousness to fruition through things like mythology and through magic. And that's what that began.
In Ireland, where you are, they all believe in leprechauns. Tell me about the myth. How did it start?
Well, it's a very complex thing. And when you start to detach the Hollywood thing from the real thing, yes, Ireland, like Iceland, Ireland's are both very modern countries, but yet this, in rural areas, people still believe in elves and fairies and all these things, like the leprechaun. Now, the leprechaun's an interesting one. Did you ever see those movies, Leprechaun? There were a bunch of Hollywood films made.
Oh, it's horrible. They scared the living daylights out of you.
Well, guess what? That's probably the most accurate portrayal of how Irish people viewed leprechauns.
Really?
Yeah, they're closer to demons.
Ah.
That's how they were. They're closer to demons. Fairies in Ireland, and you've had Rosemary Ellen Guiley on a few times, and she'll tell you the same thing. She's written about this as well. The leprechauns, the fairies, are not seen. They're seen at the very least, people are cautious of them. The country people, the older country people around here, they actually live in fear of them. They live in fear of them. They see them as demons, and they will not go. Even to this day, you will still have road projects in Ireland that will be diverted not to go through what they call a fairy fort or a fairy ring. The local, you know, engineers will say something like, "Oh, we moved the road to protect, you know, natural heritage or you know, some kind of like cultural tradition." They'll put it in that language. But at the end of the day, they moved because it was a local protest saying you will not build on that ferry ring, because if you do, there'll be car crashes on that site. And these things are reported not only in Ireland, but in Iceland, in Scotland, even in England, even in parts of North America like Nova Scotia, where Irish and Scots immigrants went, took these cultures with them. It's almost like they're an archetype that travel with a particular group, just like in the Islamic world, the jinn travel with the Islamic people. In our, you have the dibbuk in the Hebrew tradition. In our tradition, we have these things called fairies. Now, leprechaun literally is a corruption of the god Lu. The god Lu is basically one of the primary solar deities of the ancient pagan Irish. And when the Christians came along, they reduced his image to that of a little stooping leprechaun. And that's where that comes from. Now, that's what they are. They're more closer to demons here than they are to anything Disney would produce.
Could they be real?
Well, I've never seen them, okay? And I've been to some very... But I can tell you, George, for a fact, I know people who have... who are very well educated, systems analysts, top engineers, even farmers. These are people who are not, you know, people. I know even a person that calls himself an atheist, who said that they have seen these strange beings. Now, they're not all small, by the way. There's a group. I live in County Sligo, which is in the northwest coast of Ireland. It's places where the poet William Butler Yeats came from. It is saturated with folklore and fairy myth. And there's a group up here living in a mountain near where I work called Ben Bulbin. And this mountain actually, if you look at my, if people go to my Thomas Sheridan Arts YouTube channel, I will show you, and I'm not kidding you, there is a square, a perfectly rectangle limestone door in the side of the mountain that people to this day say at certain times of the year, the door opens up and these fairies called the gentry, who are all like 6 foot tall and are described very much like the elves in Tolkien's Lord of the Ring. They come out and they are elegant, tall, sophisticates, and they go actually live in cities and everything. They're almost like a parallel race to humanity, in another different time frame. But yes, it's like these people have. I mean, I'm telling you, they've told me that they believe, and I believe them. They're not lying. They're just like people I know have said they had seen UFOs. I know they're not lying. I've never seen one, but I know by their sincerity they're telling the truth.
Now, when you talk about the little fairies, what are we talking about here? Little creatures? Something mystical? What are they?
Well, let's go into the Irish mythology. Ireland doesn't have a creation myth as such. We have invasion myths. We're very different than, say, the Nordic world, which has the, you know, creation myths. We don't. We don't have that. Well, maybe we do. It just hasn't been discovered yet. We still have vast amounts of untranslated ancient texts here in Ireland that have still not been translated. But as yet, we don't have one. One of the early races that came to Ireland was a semi-mystical, elvish-like race called the Tuatha Dé Danann, meaning the people of the goddess Danu. And they came from four destroyed cities to the northwest of Ireland in the Atlantic, which is now under the sea. We can talk about this, the implications of that later. They came to Ireland, and they became they made Ireland, basically. They created our culture, our language, everything. Like, they arrived on a cloud, this kind of thing. When they came, they ruled Ireland for hundreds of years until a group called the Milesian Gaels came along. And they were another kind of race that came from Iberia. And the two of them fought these epic battles, incredible stories, to take control of Ireland. And the Tuatha Dé Danann eventually lost to the Milesian Gaels. And what happened was they then went underground to live in the barrows, the mounds, the cairns, the fairy forts, the enclosures, all these ancient megalithic sites. And they went to live inside them and would wait for the day when they would return. And that is the, they were called, then they became a group called the Sidhe, spelled S-I-D-H-E, which literally means fairy or fairy type creature in the Irish language. They live inside these places, and they are they're almost like, I can't describe, they're like aliens, but they're aliens that live on the planet. That's the best way to describe them. They're like an alien race, but they're not from another planet, they're from this planet.
And the description, little wings, things like that that we've all heard about.
No, that seems to be a thing that came along later on with Germanic and English folklore. They look just like us. They look, you know, they can, they're like humans. They dress like us. They, you know, they have their quirkiness according to things. But some of them are very elegant and very fashionable and very bling-like. Others are like rustic types. They're small. They're stumpy. The thing with the wings and the fairy thing is really a thing that grew up in England around the Middle Ages, and it became popularized with things like Shakespeare. Basically as costumes, but no, you don't really hear about the wings part.
When you've been doing all this work, what area fascinated you the most about all this mythology?
How it was real, and when I say real, I mean it was real in the sense, like, you have the great American mythologist Joseph Campbell, right? We all know
exactly.
About his work and phenomenal. The Hero with a Thousand Faces and so on. And we have Carl Jung, who did tremendous work on mythology. What you realize, what I became, and this is what I cover very much in the Druid Code, is that what mythology is not a myth. Mythology is the truest stories of all, because it is a roadmap to the human subconscious experiences. When we have experiences in our lives, we tend to mythologize them. Now, by mythologizing, I don't mean we make them fake. We make them more real in some ways. Like, I'll give you an example, 9/11. When 9/11 happened, it was such a traumatic event for anyone who witnessed it. Phenomenally traumatic event for anyone who watched it on live TV as it was unfolding.
Beyond doubt, beyond anything.
Yeah, I mean, nothing like it probably happened in history, unless we've been hit by comets or had massive tsunamis in the past that wiped us out. But people instantly began to mythologize it. You saw people talking about there were faces of demons in the smoke. There was weird stories about it. You have the conspiracy theories that come out of it, which is a very important part of the mythology. Again, not meaning it's not fake, it didn't really happen, but it helps our subconscious mind to comprehend or deal with the experience, so it doesn't drive us crazy. And this is what mythology was really about. Bruno Bettelheim, he was an American Austrian psychologist. He wrote a book called The Uses of Enchantment back in the 1970s. And he showed how just about every single European fairy tale was about trying to deal with trauma and warning children about the dangers of life. Many of them psychopaths, like just Little Red Riding Hood, the wolf is a psychopath, and so on. And all these kind, but without telling the children, look, there are monsters in this world who want to do terrible things to you. This is what they look like, and this is how they behave. It's much easier to develop a mythology, to embed it within the subconscious mind of the child, so that when they become adult and they encounter these creatures, these entities, that rather than being terrified and running away, their intuition kicks in. And that's what the Druids were doing. Something happened in the past. It had a tremendous effect on humans, and they mythologized it. And that mythology was the beginning of things like folklore, magic, and even Freemasonry and witchcraft.
Thomas, with all that has been going on in terms of mythology, primarily out of Ireland, I mean, like the four-leaf clover, how did that start?
Well, I have a whole section in my book about the number four. The number four is the most overlooked, phenomenal number out there. And when you start to see the connections between the number four, the four, I told you about the two of the Danann came to Ireland for four cities, right? Ireland is still divided into four provinces. There were four ancient capitals of Ireland. There were four Grail mysteries written by Geoffrey of Mormont. There were four treasures of Ireland brought to Ireland by the gods. They also became the four treasures of Geoffrey of Mormont in the Grail mysteries. You have the four gospels. You have the four letters of the Tetragrammaton, the name of God. You have four this, four that, four, and so on. It goes on and on. Four is a very important number. And four represents, if you look at the quadrant, the idea of the mandala. Mandalas, if you give a person who's never drawn a mandala before, they automatically divide it into four quadrants. Carl Jung discovered this, like the Celtic cross. You know the Celtic cross with the circle with the four thing? That is the same idea. That is the mandala of the Gaels, I call that. What happens is, those four quadrants represent four aspects of the human personality. Things, what Jung called the four functions, but they're naturally inherent to us. We know about them. At the center of those four quadrants, the center of that is the unknowable, the unknowable, the God, the things we don't understand. And these four functions of the psyche allow us to understand and grasp these unknowable concepts. And this is why the number four is so important. I think the four-leaf clover, that idea came from that as well. The four quadrants, it was almost like a very simplified mandala.
You believe that there was an abuse of ancient technology, don't you?
It's so strange. Like, we have to play this Atlantis story, right? Let me tell you, there's a megalithic arc around Europe. It starts in Norway, it goes through Orkney and through Shetland Islands, the Western Isles of Scotland, through Scotland, down through England, north of England, into Ireland, then southern England. It begins again across to Breton. In France, Brittany, down into Celt Iberia, Spain, Portugal, Avora, those places, around into Sardinia and into Malta and then a bit of Sicily. It's a perfect arc. And all the megalithic structures date from the same time and they're all very, very similar. And so is the artwork, like the rock carvings and so on. It suggests a common civilization. But it also suggests, because I've seen so many of these things now, that these are extremely ancient ruins of a very high technology civilization. To be able to do things like put perfect squares and gigantic boulders, to lift 60 ton stones and put them into a slot 30 feet up in the air. We're talking about incredible technology. To be able to cut perfect right angles on stone, and you have the archaeologists telling you they did that with an antler head, and you're sitting there, you're not serious, and they say that's what and the thing looks like it's been cut with a laser, precision of a laser. And so yes, we know from Plato, he said that they messed with magic and this magic caused all kinds of problems. The Irish mythology talks about a great disaster very similar to the Nordic idea of Ragnarok. Now, the disaster, what's interesting about the Irish thing is that it's remembered through a non-human entity called the Somlath. Now, the Somlath is almost like an energetic form that exists in all living creatures that carries the racial DNA memory of all the experiences of these living creatures. And it talks about, the same theme comes up again. There was a world of circles, magic circles. They laid out their buildings in concentric circles. This is a common theme. So the circle, the circle, the circle, the round. Something happened. There was a flood, a tsunami. In Ireland, it's described as a tsunami in terms of a gigantic black pig devastating the countryside and going back to the ocean and coming back again. We know that in 2500 BC, Orkney, Ireland, was basically sterilized of most human life. Something happened. If you look at the west coast of Ireland, the west coast of Scotland, it looks like it's been torn to pieces.
Yeah, something dramatic happened.
A tsunami was caused, something caused a tsunami, because where I live on the mountains is the boulders on the bottom of the ocean, on the top of the mountains.
Could have been an asteroid strike.
Yeah, I think it could have been something like that. Who knows? Maybe they were so far advanced they could do things like this. I mean, we just don't know. We know from the Vedas in India that they talk about advanced technology. You know, 10,000 years ago, the Irish mythology talks about very similar things. You have talk about bionic arms. There's a guy called Nuada of the silver arm. His arm is lost. A druid makes him a new arm that's made of silver and it gives him extra strength and he, as well.
And it works. Thomas, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back with more. I definitely want to find out about what could have happened to Atlantis and this high technology. We'll take phone calls about psychopaths. And of course, about the occult.